Right, so the battle for the soul of South Africa. There are similarities between America and South Africa that are quite remarkable. Some intriguing similarities between our history and that of the United States. Shortly after Portuguese explorer Bartholomew Dias first landed on the shores of South Africa in 1488, the Spanish explorer, Christopher Columbus, actually is Italian, but he was working for Spain, landed in the Americas 1492. Although, to the end of his days, he thought he'd landed in Asia. But yeah. Never mind, he'd done a great thing. From the 1600s onward, both America and South Africa were settled by pilgrims from Holland, France, England, Scotland, Germany, seeking religious freedom. Interesting that the original name of New York was New Amsterdam, and they still have Harlem and other Dutch names there. And it seems the British have a habit of taking what the Dutch establish and take it for themselves. While American pioneers were moving westwards in horse-drawn covered wagons to settle a mostly uninhabited interior, South African fur trekkers, or pioneers, were embarking on the Great Trek northwards and eastwards, also in covered wagons, although our wagons were pulled by oxen, who couldn't go quite as fast as the horses did, but then again, they could carry weight that the horses couldn't as well. Just as the American pioneers crossed the Rocky Mountains, so the fur trekkers crossed the vast Drakensberg Mountains. And as the pioneers drew the wagons in a circle to defend their families from hostile attacks, so the fur trekkers formed the laager. Both South Africa and America had a gold rush, and we had a diamond rush as well. And both our countries fought the redcoats. Both our nations endured a vicious war between the states. Although in our case, the northerners were the good guys. South Africa was even known as the Union of South Africa, which you could have abbreviated to USA, between 1910 and 1960, when we became the Republic of South Africa, RSA. In our history, you'll also find remarkable similarities between great Christian leaders of our two nations, the President of South African Republic, Transvaal, Paul Kruger, Paul Kruger, and his contemporary, President Teddy Roosevelt, were both far-sighted visionary conservationists who founded national parks. Well, I think Kruger National Park is vastly superior to whatever they've got going in America. President Steyn, Martina Steyn of the Orange Free State, and U.S. founding father George Washington also stand out as courageous Christian men of principle. The Orange Free State General Christian De Wet and the Virginian General Robert E. Lee were both outstanding strategists, staunchly principled men of God, much loved by the soldiers, even in the face of crushing defeat, which is very hard to maintain your men's morale at that sort of time. And both were greatly respected by the enemies. In fact, when Christian De Wet went to Britain after the Anglo-Boer War, he was cheered by people in London, just a couple of years after the war, which is quite extraordinary. Boer General Deloray and Confederate General Stonewall Jackson also shared a boldness and a bravery on the battlefield that inspired their followers to heroic achievements. And both Deloray and Stonewall Jackson died from friendly fire, both shot by their own side. Stonewall Jackson's death at the end of his greatest victory, Chancellorsville, was probably cost the Confederates the war, because he wouldn't have made the same mistakes that others made at Gettysburg, which was decisive. But General Deloray opposed our involvement in the First World War, and he was on his way with General Christian Bayer's who was the Commandant General of the Union Defense Force, who had just resigned his commission in protest over us going to fight for our previous enemies against our previous allies. What was the point? South Africa hadn't been attacked. It wasn't our war. Is this not reasonable? And Deloray was shot by the police at a roadblock and on their way to the Potchefstroom Army base, where they were going to address soldiers about the fact that this wasn't a just war. And the police later said they mistook him for a bank robber, which is highly suspect. The military mistakes and heroism of Custer's last stand were almost duplicated in the Battle of Isandlwana in Zululand, which was the worst defeat of the British Army at the hands of a native army in history. Absolute catastrophic. 1,600 redcoats wiped out in one day, in fact in 2 hours, effectively. But on the same day, the courageous defense of Rorke's Drift in Natal, it's almost like the Alamo in Texas, except that our people won in Rorke's Drift and survived incredibly. On these and hundreds of other occasions, the common ancestry common religious convictions and similar conditions of South African America in the pioneering days can be seen. I mean, some of the courage, like in the saving of the colors on the day of Isandlwana, and a tremendous heritage. South Africans also fought alongside their American allies in the First World War, the Second World War, and the Korean War. More importantly, though, South Africans have shared a common Christian heritage and missionary vision with America and Britain, for example. Now, there are four M's that, to me, summarize why South Africa is so important. And the first M is minerals. All of these things. It would be impossible to overemphasize the strategic importance of South Africa to the industrial nations of the West, or the missionary enterprise of the church. But South Africa contains some of the world's largest known deposits of gold, platinum, chrome, manganese, vanadium, fluspar. We also contain substantial deposits of antimony, asbestos, copper, diamonds, iron ore, lead, phosphate, titanium, and uranium. And without these strategic minerals, Europe and America could not manufacture air conditioners, refrigerators, motor vehicles, or jet aircraft, or spacecraft, satellites, and can just keep going. That's one M, minerals. Secondly, maritime. In addition, the Cape Sea Route is the busiest sea route in the world, with an average of over 26,000 ships sailing past South Africa every year. This, by the way, is a red Chinese tanker coming past. Fortunately, on this occasion, not sinking and dousing our shores in oil, which they've done a couple of occasions. More than 30% of America's oil imports, more than 50% of Europe's, Western Europe's oil supplies, and over 25% of Western Europe's food supply travels around the Cape of Good Hope, around our shores. You can see how we really dominate the seas and why this was considered the most strategic naval station in the world. Especially when you consider this vast ocean that we're responsible for. This is how they've divided up the world in terms of responsibility for navies. And you can see, you know, some of the places like Russia have got quite a small area they're responsible for. America's got quite large areas. But look at South Africa's area. It's a huge area that we are responsible for any naval rescue operations and so on. Our navy's never been big. In fact, as an infantryman, an army person myself, I had a kind of prejudice that the navy is not that important. In fact, in the old South African Defence Force, the navy was always 10% of the budget. And I said, well, you know, navy is not that important. And I remember sitting at Walvis Bay Naval Base doing ministry chaplaincy work with them at the time. And the admiral there was saying to me, but we should be a naval power because we sit astride a huge ocean. And most of our border is actually coastal. If we had a bigger navy, you wouldn't have had to be fighting the Cubans in Angola because we could have blockaded Luanda, naval-wise, and the Cubans and their weapons wouldn't have even gotten to the border to threaten Southwest Africa. And I had not thought about that. I must say, I'm a bit of a, you know, boots on the ground, carrying hulking great big weapons and so on through the bush. I hadn't thought of how important our navy could be. So we actually have cut our own throat historically by not having a bigger and stronger navy. But our navy was dedicated and very capable. The third M is military. And I was introduced to the South African military in 1979. And Poles, Pol PT, Drum PT, and also, of course, your Tire PT. But, of course, the only way you can run 8.4 kilometers with these is teamwork. And, well, of course, our dear friends at Simon's Town, the naval chaps, they would have nice, hulking, great big sandbags or even concrete blocks to run with. This is the ARP CAS at Tempe and Bloemfontein to practice. And then there is Rock PT. And you couldn't believe how long we had to keep those things up there. And, yeah, this thing was not fun. And they're all the different types of, this is what they call the pain tame, the pain farm. Garden, pain garden, there we go, painting. Rifle PT, amazing what you can do with rifles. Buddy PT, you have to be able to run with full kit. Notice we're wearing our backpacks and helmets and so on, and rifles, two rifles. What happens if your buddy gets injured? You've got to be able to pick him up and run under fire. So running either scarf draw or fireman this Farman Way was easier, but the scarp drive in front of you, very hard. Our dear friends Tusai up at Wolfish Bay had the joy of climbing dunes, but we all had the joy of going through mud under barbed wire, and they would actually machine gun over you. They would have a fixed Vickers machine gun, tuck, 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 tuck. Now you're under barbed wire, so even if you panic, it's going to keep you there, but still, to hear live rounds going over your head, it's something that freezes your blood, and you've got to get over things like fear of heights and all of that sort of thing. These are just some of the fun obstacle courses. Shooting range. Fun. I don't know how many hundreds of rounds we shot on these shooting ranges. But now, let me remind you, this is what, you know, they talk about gap years these days for youngsters. This is our gap year. We just had a gap 2 year. And it was, survival. These are 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds. Funny how the army could take boys who couldn't make their bed at home to making impeccable beds, polishing floors. Now, I'm sorry to say that because I was brought up in Rhodesia with four servants, gardener, cook, butler, and so on, I'd never polished a pair of boots or scrubbed a floor or polished anything or ironed anything before I went to the army. But boy, did I learn how to do it there. And I, to this day, can iron better than any domestic, and I can scrub and clean anything better than any domestic I've ever seen do it. And, in fact, to the extent that I insist on cleaning my own office and everything else, I'm not interested in anyone else coming in and messing it up. So the army took boys and made men of us. And these inspections, I mean, you think how we've got these wimpy little snowflakes these days, afraid of they need their safe spaces because somebody's hurt them and offended them and so on. Well, we just had to get out there and crawl to... One of the things an obstacle course was when you come across the bayonet... when you come across the barbed wire rolls, the first one flings himself in a barbed wire, and you then use it as a springboard. Everyone else runs, puts a foot, hopefully in the small of your back on your webbing, and you bounce, and each time you bounce, the barbed wire is going deeper and deeper. And the last two to go, they grab you by the webbing from the back and pull you over, and then you hopefully don't rip too much of your browns, but they were well-made browns, so normally we manage okay. But the whole idea is seconds counts. If there's an obstacle, you've got to get over it quick, teamwork and all that sort of thing. And we learned to make a plan. Now, let me remind you, these are 18, 19 and 20-year-olds. And we were forged into a fighting force that the world has not seen in a long time. And we learned how to survive in the bush. We learned how to fight in the bush. We went up into Angola, Namibia. These aren't actually South African Army as much, well, a Southwest Territorial Force using the Caspers. Normally Kufut, the police and so on, would use Caspers. We wouldn't use Caspers, although there were some units in the Army, like the Southwest Territorial Force, like 101 Battalion, which used Caspers. The South African Defence Force proved itself to be the superpower of Africa. I didn't know we had so many tanks until suddenly 1988. It turned very, very conventional up at the border with Ops Hooper, Ops Modular. We were fighting whole mechanized divisions of the Cubans. These are some of our older Sabres. Then the Mirages, which we're more familiar with. And, I mean, did you know we had such a phenomenal air force? This is more combat-ready fighter aircraft on that landing strip there than we've got in the whole of Southern National Defence Force at this moment. We're not short of aircraft as much as pilots. Do you know that the American Apache helicopter is Arms Corps designed? It's what we call the Royfalk. We designed it to counter the Soviet Mi-8, the Mi-24 Hunt helicopter gunships. And this South African designed Royfalk is what the Americans call the Apache, which is their primary tank killing ground attack helicopter, designed in South Africa. Did you know that we had 8 nuclear bombs in South Africa? These are them. We even designed intercontinental ballistic missiles that we could handle from Pearl Harbor. South Africa had the ability to send a nuclear weapon anywhere they wanted in the world. We had that ability. In fact, we've had, speaking at one of our biblical worldview summits, the man who was involved in taking down, we're the only country in the world that had a nuclear capability that totally dismantled, destroyed, and got rid of even the plans, so it couldn't be reconstructed. And that was quite a task. This is part of the test phase of it. And We had phenomenal missile and nuclear capabilities. This is just one of South Africa's nuclear delivery vehicles that were designed and available. At the 75th anniversary of the South African Defence Force in 1987, we could declare that the SADF had never been beaten in battle. We had an unbroken record of victory, most recently against the Cubans in Angola. Now, I heard that many a time, but I know that that's not totally true, because the 6th South African Infantry Division, which I was trained in, 6i, we were beaten by Rommel in 1942 at Tobruk, and I know some of the people who went into Colditz Castle and so on, into the Stalags as prisoners afterwards. So we were actually beaten once before, but I think because we were under British generals, maybe they thought they could say the SADF has never been beaten. But I could think of that example because in 6i we were often talking about Tobruk, and Tobruk was one time our people were definitely beaten. But there's a story there too. Have you seen the pictures of Erwin Rommel, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, the Africa Corps? And he's always got these goggles on his Field Marshal's hat, correct? Most of you have seen that. But those goggles aren't German issue. They are South African issue. How is he ending up with Southern goggles on his hat? I forget, it might have been General Pino, but it was a South African general, and his daughter gave the story a while ago through the Moths, members of the Tin Hat, which I'm a member of. And what happened was her father was captured at Tobruk, and of course, as with all officers, they were invited to the tent of Erwin Rommel, the Field Marshal, for dinner, which was his normal politeness towards captured enemy. He was always very, very correct, proper, and thoughtful. And he immediately asked the South African general, "Where's your hat?" And he said, "One of your officers took it as a souvenir." Well, Erwin Rommel was furious, called his adjutant, rattled off some commands in German, and a very short order, the offending officer came running in and handed over the hat to the South African general with his apologies, clicked his heels, saluted, and left. And the general felt such gratitude to Erwin Rommel, he had nothing to give him, really. They gave him his goggles. So that's how Erwin Rommel ended up for the rest of the war wearing his South African issue goggles on German uniform, which was not just a sign of his chivalry, but a sign of respect for his enemy. He respected the South African infantry, and he wrote about how well they fought, that he wore like a badge of honor the Southern goggles on his hat, which is an interesting story. And I'd never put those things together till this daughter of the South African general, whose name I've forgotten, but I'll dig it up. So the SADF had a tremendous track record. This, if anyone's been up there on Dang, Sector 10 of Amberland, this is what you'd see. Impalas coming in, radar, and this is looking over the Shawnas of Amberland, looking towards Angola. Alouettes up in the air, some of our anti-aircraft protection around the base. The SADF carried out one of the most successful counterinsurgency operations against Soviet-backed SWAPO terrorists in Southwest Africa for 26 years. One of the most phenomenal, successful anti-terrorist campaigns in history. This is our South African paratroopers in Angola taking out their base at Smokeville. The SADF blunted the southward advance of Soviet expansionism in Africa, and for 15 years we faced the best Cuban, Soviet, East German weaponry and personnel in conventional warfare, and we defeated them every single time. And despite international sanctions, South Africa's Arms Corps developed some of the most highly advanced, battle-tested conventional weaponry that proved itself time and again against the best Soviet weapons and Cuban mechanized divisions in Angola. And this is Scratch 1 MiG in Angola. This is some of the combat photography from one of our Mirages. And this is MiG on the ground in Angola. And an MI-8 helicopter on the ground in Angola. And another MI-8 on the ground in Angola. T-34. More T-34s have been made than any other tank in the history of the world. More T-34s have been destroyed than any other tank in the history of the world. And the SADF took out quite a few hundred of them in Angola too. This is a mechanized column, Cuban mechanized column, taken out by one of us Impala, which is meant to be a training aircraft, but it's a jet, in a ground attack in Angola, and they took out this entire column. And here's the UNITA picking through the remains of it. Now, when you come under air attack, you're meant to bomb shell. Everyone sprinted off the side to provide anything other than a linear target for a strafing aircraft. These were all taken out in one go. It just shows how phenomenally accurate our ground attack capabilities were of our South African Air Force. And here's some of the mirages from top down. You can see that's why you have camouflage from the top, hard to see from above, and then they'll have blue underneath, hard to see from below. Yeah. This is the enemy. This is a MiG. This is the kind of bad guys we were up against in Angola. That's what you don't want to see, which is, and I've been strafed by enemy aircraft on the ground on missions. This is one of our Mirages shooting an air-to-air missile. And there are documentations of different dogfights which our South African Air Force Mirages had against MiGs in Angola. And these are documented kills where the South African Air Force time and again beat the MiGs. Now, the MiGs were in many cases better and more advanced aircraft than our Mirages. We were under sanctions. We had to make do with old aircraft that we had bought in the 60s. And we had to keep upgrading the weapon systems. And it was hard. I mean, our planes are much, much, much older and older generations than what we were fighting. And yet our people won time and again. And here's taking out one of their planes in Angola. You can see here's a helicopter being taken out, the sequences. Here's a MiG that had to make an emergency landing. Another one that was shot down. This one is totaled. This is a Stinger missile hit. Stinger missiles, which Ronald Reagan provided to UNITA back at that time. 1982, news headlines of Russian MiG shot down in Angola. That was quite news in the early 80s. In 87, 88, it became regular after we were shooting down MiGs. We also produced the most advanced artillery howitzers in the world. This is a 155mm howitzer, the so-called G5s. And these G5s were so good, Saddam Hussein bought them for Iraq, the Americans bought them from us too, when they went to fight Iraq, because they had nothing this good. This is still the best howitzer that you can get, a 155. You just won't believe what these things... Well, I'll show you what these things can do just now. Flamethrower practice. You heard of the Stalin organs? 122mm rocket launchers. This is the Boerter organ, PW Boerter organ. This is our reply, 127mm multiple rocket launcher. These things can take a grid like a kilometer squared and just destroy everything in it. Horrible sound when you're hearing it coming in. Quite nice when it's going out. We've been on the receiving end. I remember being in the South African Army at first when you heard an aircraft was support. You know, the aircraft are all outside. But towards the end, if you heard aircraft, you paid attention, is the Soviet or Cuban Air Force or is it our side? Because their side had more than we did. This is a surface-to-surface missile on its way. And this is the old, or what would this be? G4, is it? This is a 4.4 inch, isn't it? This is the kind of thing we would have used in the Korean War. Really old stuff. Enemy trenches, enemy tanks. Now, here's just a few examples of the SADF at work. And notice it takes quite a lot to shoot the turret. This is what, maybe 5-6 tons flying off the base of this tank. This is a G5. That's a 155mm howitzer from one of our G5s that took a Soviet tank, 55 tons, lifted it in the air, crashed it upside down with its pieces in different directions. Can you imagine the impact to throw a 55 ton tank high in the air and put it down its back in pieces? This is Lomba River Op Super and Modular, and Russian tanks destroyed. There are places in Angola where you can go today and you'll still see graveyards of hundreds of destroyed Soviet tanks, testifying to the hot part of the Cold War, the sharp end of the war. And this is what our soldiers look like. And these are 18, 19, 20-year-old boys. And we had to make decisions on which our lives dependent, not just our lives, but other people's lives. And these are just some of what you see of the Soviet destruction. Now, there are websites set up by our Russian friends, the people on the other side, where they have now written books, such as Angola, the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. Angola, we never saw it, not even in Afghanistan. And things like that. They're writing books about how the Soviet Union died in Angola. It was the Spetsnaz, that's the special forces of the Soviet Union, have the names of 800 of their Spetsnaz, that's their special force soldiers who died, were killed in action in Angola, fighting the South Africans. 800. That's more than all of our SADF losses in the 26 years of the war. Fred Bridgeland, an English writer, wrote this book on the Battle for Africa, speaking about the Cuban-South African conflict in Angola. Most people don't know about it, but you just heard the quote from Kuhn, which was made by our dear friend Arthur Conan Doyle 118 years ago. That same quote was made by Sir Walter Walker, head of NATO, when his head of NATO, he came to the border in Angola back in the early 80s, and he took this quote from Conan Doyle about the fact that the Boers are, with the incredible lineage of the Boers, and how they're some of the most rugged, virile, unconquerable races upon the earth, and how they've been trained in warfare for constant generations against savage men, ferocious beasts, and they have an exceptional skill in weapons and horsemanship. And he then spoke about their fatalistic Old Testament religion and ardent, consuming patriotism. Combine all these qualities and all these impulses in one individual, and you have the modern Boer, speaking about the 1900 Boer, the most formidable antagonist to ever cross the path of Imperial Britain. Then he added, our military history has largely consisted in our conflicts with France, but Napoleon and all his veterans never treated us so roughly as these hard-bitten farmers with the ancient theology and the inconveniently modern rifles. This is the monument to the Bitter Einde in Bloemfontein by the Women's Monument, Anglo-Boer War Museum outside Bloemfontein. And it sort of shows a finished horse and a man who's dressed in rags and tatters. He's still got his Mauser 7.7, and others have laid down their rifles, but he's fighting the very end. And that's people like Delarey, De Wet, Tina Stang. And Sir Walter Walker made that quote, and then he made the statement, the South African infantry is the finest infantry in the world today. There is no other army in the world that has 9 months rigorous training. I mean, the Americans would take people, train them 6 weeks and put them into Vietnam. South Africa, we were trained 9 months of such intensity before we were deployed. And then we'd be deployed for up to 15 months in total. And then you'd be called up time and again. So Walter Walker, head of NATO, said the South African infantry is the best infantry in the world. There's no army in the world that could compare. And now we're talking about 1980s. And this is the army, and that's the flag we marched under. And when people come up with and say that's the apartheid flag, it's rubbish. Predates apartheid by how many years? And this is from 1926. This is the flag that General James Barry Hertzog, most popular Prime Minister of South Africa, elected 5 times in succession. He is the one who gave us that flag, and that flag represents our British Free State, Transvaal heritage, and it honors the Prince of Orange. At one hostile press conference in Windhoek, Colonel Dion Ferreira, operational commander of Ops Modular, Ops Hoopen Packer, he's actually head of 3-2 Battalion 2, that's why he's got this camouflage beret. So Colonel Ferreira was challenged to respond to accusations that South Africans had been beaten in the just concluded battles in Angola. This is his response. If defeat for South Africa meant the loss of 31 men, 3 tanks, 5 armored vehicles, and 3 aircraft, then we lost. If victory for FAPLA and the Cubans meant the loss of 4,600 men, 94 tanks, 100 armored vehicles, 9 aircraft, and other Soviet equipment valued at more than R1 billion, then they won. That's a typical tongue-in-cheek 3-2 battalion type answer. I mean, we flattened them. We absolutely slaughtered these guys. And you know the absolute proof of who won the war in Angola? You don't execute the generals of victorious armies. Fidel Castro took his friend, who was the Marshal, General Sanchez, of all of the forces over even the Soviets and all in Angola. He's the Cuban general in charge of the entire operation in Angola. They put him against the wall and they shot him for losing the war against the fascist, racist lackeys of the Running Dogs and so on and so forth. So, yes, you might hear some nonsense these days about what happened in Angola, but I was there and we saw it and we still go there. And today you can see by the Lomba River, yep, that looks like a MiG. And that is a Soviet tank. And yes, those are BRDMs. And this is a graveyard of Soviet weaponry destroyed, and they're going nowhere. Hundreds of them. These are pictures taken since the war, long after. I mean, they're going nowhere. You can Google Lomba River, Google Earth it, and you can see. You can go right down, and they're still there. I mean, those very tanks, they're still there. They're going nowhere. The kids and I are using them as playthings and jungle gyms. We shattered the entire presidential mechanized division of Fidel Castro, his best. He sent in his best, the presidential guard, because he couldn't stand the idea that Cuba was losing, and they got wiped out too. And that was the last hot battle of the Cold War. Now, I don't know if you remember, but I think it was in 1992, when the Cold War was officially declared over, as the Soviet Union pulled down their red flag and hoisted up the Russian flag, they said, the Cold War was a war in which no one was killed and no bullets were fired. Anything. Have you not heard of the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Angolan War, the Rhodesian War? A lot of people died in the Cold War. I mean, could Slime magazine be that stupid? Or do they think that their listeners and readers are that stupid? General Yoni Heldnes did an excellent book on We Were There and How We Won. Colonel Jan Breitenbach's written History of the Reckies and 3-2 Battalion very effectively. There's a lot of good books out in this. We've even got a summary of it all on how the Cubans lost the war in Angola. We've got that, you know. We should still have that in hand. The victory of the West over Soviet expansionism in the Cold War was in no small measure thanks to South Africa's military resistance. I've had some South Africans say, you know, we fought on the border and it was all for nothing. No, it was not for nothing. We helped win the Cold War. We saved the day, not just for Southwest Africa, not just for South Africa, not just for Angola. We saved the day for all of the world. We helped bring down the Soviet Union. We helped bring freedom even for the people in Russia. The Russian military generals and colonels are writing books today saying how it was when the Russians couldn't even beat the South Africans that they thought, we've got no chance. And that was the end of the Soviet Union, because they knew that the West decadent. The West is weak. But when they couldn't, and they knew they couldn't beat the Soviet Union, couldn't beat the United States at a nuclear war, but they thought they could at least win a conventional war. When they couldn't even win a conventional war with the best of their equipment on the ground in South Africa, against South Africans. And we were under the restriction of sanctions. And we still managed to beat the Soviets. He said their morale was shattered. And he said that ripple effect went all the way through. Of course, Ronald Reagan's tactics, helping the Contras in Nicaragua, helping the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, all that played a part. The Renamo in Mozambique, and Nita in Angola. There were many people who were the Bible smugglers, Radio Free Europe, a lot of Christians working behind the lines of Soviet Union. I mean, many worked to bring down the Soviet Union. But we did play a part. That's the third M, military. Fourth M for South Africa, the battle for South Africa's missions. South Africa is still the most important missionary sending nation in the Southern Hemisphere and in Africa as well. The South African churches continue to form the main missionary base, the main missionary sending base for all of Africa. South Africa is one of the most important bases for gospel radio broadcasts, for Bible translation, for gospel literature production in Africa. One of my treasured items, it's normally in my office, but I brought it out here today, it's of a South African soldier kneeling with his Bible in his hand, the little compact Good News Bibles that we had, and an R1 rifle. This was an initiative by soldiers in Sector 20, privates, not chaplains, normal soldiers, riflemen. And they made these and they sold these. And I bought this, memory serves me correct, 70 Rand. I'm talking about early 1980s money, when we were only getting about 240 Rand a month salary, I think, in the army, something like that. So that was, you know, like a significant amount of money. But all the money went to Bible translation, to the Bible study for Bible translation into the Kwanyama language in Braille. A lot of people had lost their sight due to landmines and terrorist activities, and so soldiers decided to make this a project. And those who made these, you can actually feel it's quite a substantial weight. Those who made these donated all the money, 100%, to Bible translation. Now, might into the Kwanyama language in Braille. This is just one of many, many, many examples. Most people are not aware that the SADF was the biggest funder of Bible translations and Bible production in Africa. The SADF. When the SADF closed down national service, along with its compulsory voluntary tithes that went to Bible, we got tithed in the army automatically. Our voluntary tithe was automatically deducted. And it didn't go to the army because the army had a budget and they had chaplains. It wasn't for our Bibles even. I mean, that was provided by the chaplains' funds. This went always to the Bible Society. The Bible Society got tens of millions of rands a year from the SADF, both in tithes and offerings for specifically Bible translation projects. And so when our mission started, I remember going up to Southwest Africa, 1990, we'd just pulled out, Southwest Africa's now Namibia. I went to Bible House and I was wanting Bibles from Angola, and they were so ecstatic to see me, and they gave me fire sale prices, thousands of Bibles in Angolan languages of Ovumbundu and all other languages there, Portuguese and Lavali, Lachazi. They were giving us these at real fire sale price because they'd been printing them for the SADF, who was distributing Bibles across the board on operations, but now they'd lost the customer, and so there's never going to be anyone else wanting these again. And along came my mission saying, we'd like Bibles in Ovumbundu, Lachazi and Lavali, and they were delighted because they couldn't do anything with them. I don't think many people realized, and they were scaling down, they were closing down Bible House in Windhoek and moving to some little place because they'd never again have the same level of support. I don't know how many people know that there was a time when Cape Town was the biggest Bible production city in the world, bigger even than Stuttgart. But that's past now. Now, if you go in the KwaZulu-Natal, you're flying up there in the mountains, this is the Kop where Shaka used to throw people off, and you come across the most successful mission station in Africa. This is Kwasi Sabantu Mission, the place that helps people. It's got one of the most phenomenal schools. They often have had award-winning students, even the best students in the year on occasion. This is the auditorium. It can seat 10,000. Kwasi Sabantu Mission, a site of revival since 1966 at Masipumalele down the road, now they've been here since about 1970. And you can see the cultivation. Reverend Erle Stegen, third generation German settler to South Africa, Lutheran background, with King Goodwill Zwelithini, calls Uncle Erle God's apostle to the Zulus. In fact, King Goodwill says the best Zulu in Zululand is spoken by Uncle Erle. Uncle Erle speaks better Zulu than I do. I learn Zulu diction and pronunciation from Uncle Erle. He's the gold standard. And this auditorium, since 1990, they have ministers' conferences with 1,000 up to 1,500 ministers at a time every 2 years. They have spoken at youth conferences there. They have huge amounts of youth conferences. At youth conferences, there's their school choir. And this school wins tremendous awards. They have conferences, Christians for Truth conferences. Uncle Erle, despite being in his 80s, is still going down into plant new mission stations, like here in the Tugela Valley, which is very close to where Nkandla is. And we, in fact, sometimes fly right past Zuma's place. And Uncle Erle is making the ground produce all sorts of things where the people said we didn't know anything but thorn bushes could grow. He's growing everything. Local people love him. Another mission from South Africa. Back to the Bible mission. This is run by General Shai Mulder. And he's got over 100 students from over 20 countries in Africa. At any one time, they go through the whole Bible. This is a great commission course that I was running up in Nairobi. About 2,000 people there. I think, can you see the one whitey in the whole, one pale face there in the middle? In Kenya. South Africa is still sending missionaries throughout the world, all over the world, as far as Mongolia and Kazakhstan. And these are in Sudan. Zambia, with Biblical Principles Africa. This mission house regularly fits in things you wouldn't imagine. We process something in the region of 160 tons of Bibles and books a year, on average. And so our driveway is often very busy. Jonathan is handling at Literature for Africa huge amounts, and our cats keep the place rodent-free. That's Florence. She's the oldest cat on the premises. She's 15 years this year. And people donate Bibles to us, all sorts, hardcover, paperback, all different types of translations, although New King James is our favorite. And we deliver and distribute them throughout Africa, as far afield as you can go, all the way up to Sudan, Egypt even, and Nigeria. So we fly in the Bibles and the books. This is the largest shipment of Bibles ever smuggled to an officially Islamic country. That's an old South African Air Force DC-3 Dakota with turboprop conversion. Used to be in South African Air Force. The pilot was ex-South African Air Force too. Now mercenary flying for money because nobody would go in there illegally risking their life and their property without being quite brave. This is a South African Land Rover that we drove up from Johannesburg, converted to an ambulance, donated to the hospital. This is 9,700 Bibles and New Testaments in seven different languages. The largest shipment of Bibles ever smuggled to an officially Islamic country at that time. On an airstrip that used to be in the hands of Arabs that had only just been liberated by the SPLA, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. And this has just been beaten. Our team's just taken 34,000 Bibles into the Nuba Mountains, which is the largest shipment ever into a Muslim country. And that's a story that they'll be talking about next week. They only just got back this last Thursday. 3,000 of the first Bibles in the Moro language. You can see one of those, which we completely sponsored now, behind glass. This church has been bombed many a time, destroyed three times. And so putting Bibles in the hands and Bible teaching to chaplains, pastors, teachers throughout Africa, that's just what our mission is. So speaking about the battle for Africa, Brother Andrew in the book, Battle for Africa, wrote, "One nation could save all of Africa. I believe that God has a special interest in the survival of the South African nation. The continent of Africa is of special spiritual responsibility of South Africa. Why? Because South Africa has the tools to reach the entire continent. It has the money, the technology, a large number of committed Christians, the freedom and the relative political stability. It has everything needed to evangelize the continent of Africa, to equip black Africans and other countries to participate in the process, and to get the job done all the way from the Cape of Good Hope, which is where we are right now, to the Sahara Desert. And we have just sent a team right to the edge of the Sahara Desert this last month, and they're back. And I further believe," said Brother Andrew, "that God will intervene in the course of history to preserve South Africa if her people will accept her responsibility to evangelize the rest of the continent." Is that not what Jan van Riebeck prayed on his first day, 6th of April, 1650, in Nelson Table Bay, and he prayed that the faith would be spread throughout the continent of Africa? That's why we're here. We're here to be a blessing to the continent of Africa. We're blessed in order to be a blessing. We're a country with a mission. Lauren Cunningham, founder of International Youth for the Mission, said when he visited South Africa, "God will save your country if you send your young people to the ends of the earth with the gospel." At the Great Voortrekker Monument in Pretoria, a wall mural recalls the symbolic gift of a Bible from English-speaking 1820 settlers to the departing Voortrekkers, and the message was, "God has placed us at the foot of Africa to spread the light of the gospel of Christ throughout Africa." Now, disinformation and propaganda are essential parts of warfare today. Communist revolutionaries regard the information war as key to winning hearts and minds, or at least creating enough confusion that people don't know what to do or who to fight when they're attacked. This is a picture that's got a story. Here you can see, this is in Angola, training terrorists, training base. These are Russian commissars. Notice the Marx brothers, Frederick Engels, Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin, the trinity of evil. And that's Dos Santos, the dictator of Angola at that time. This is the Vietnamese flag. What on earth is Vietnamese flag doing? This picture was taken in Luanda Harbor, Soviet warship and battleship in Angola Harbor. What most people in South Africa do not seem to understand, unless they live through it, is the Cold War context. You know, when you see the Mandela Long Walk to Freedom and Victor's films and all, they all leave out the Cold War context. South Africa wasn't in a vacuum. A apartheid didn't happen in a vacuum. The suppression of Communism Act, suppression of Terrorism Act didn't happen in a vacuum. This was the context. To understand South African history, we need to understand the African context. The violence, the massacres, the Idi Amins, the lawlessness that so often went along with the decolonization process, the emperors for life who declared themselves all sorts of things. This led South Africans to naturally attempt to ensure that such things as this never happened here. At least we tried. Liberia. Liberia means liberty. This is what independence meant, tying a man to the stake and shooting him. The Idi Amins of this world. Chief in Rhodesia being shot by Mugabe's ZANU-PF. To understand the horror and the shock that followed the Mau Mau atrocities in Kenya in the 1950s, the horrendous massacres in the Congo by the communist Simba revolutionaries in the 1960s. This was the context. South Africa was not imagining a threat. There was a real threat. People were being hacked to death. Missionaries were being killed in the Congo by the hundreds. Christians by the thousands and tens of thousands. There were massacres throughout Africa. And that was why South Africa was trying to say, not here. Of course, there's the other context of, well, how Dingaan reacted and how he betrayed agreements. And there's a history. People do things for a reason. There's always a context. And Mau Mau was a context of Kenya. And quite a few of those people came here. Yes, I'm afraid this is part of what we're dealing with. You've also got to understand the Soviet threat. These are Russian missiles in Luanda, capital of Angola. That's in our neighboring country. Well, it was our neighboring country when Southwest Africa was part of South Africa. The Cold War was an ever-present reality from 1950s throughout the end of 1980s. Here's Cuban troops marching in front of Che Guevara's ugly mug in Luanda Harbor in Angola. The Soviet Union and Red China really were arming and training Marxist revolutionaries throughout Africa. In 13 countries in Africa, communist countries, tens of thousands of Cuban troops were propping up unelected Marxist dictators. There were 55,000 Cuban soldiers in Angola at any one time. Ultimately, 650,000 served in, if you can use the word served, in Angola. There were horrific atrocities taking place in Portuguese East Africa, Mozambique, Portuguese West Africa, Angola. The communist Frelimo campaign in Mozambique began with the decapitation of a Catholic priest in the church and the desecration of the altar. People knew this. That was the daily news at that time. It wasn't suppressed. These are just listing revolutions and all that across Africa. Coup d'etats. In Angola, the Marxist MPLA began the campaign with a massacre of 43 women and children who were fed, literally fed through buzzsaws at a chainsaw in a timber mill. That was the beginning of the liberation of Angola. The murder of whole families in Rhodesia, the landmine campaigns, the RPG and mortar attacks on farms, the limpet mines and railway stations at shopping centres, the bombs such as in Church Street, Pretoria, Kalahari Sands Hotel in Windhoek, the ANC terrorist attacks on Sasol, the Caltex oil refineries in Cape Town. They shot RPGs into those tanks, hoping to ignite them. They shot mortars into them from the N7, hoping to ignite them. Imagine if Caltex oil refinery had gone up. They tried to blow up the Kubi nuclear power station. 1982, was it? ANC tried it. That wouldn't have exactly helped. How many people in Cape Town know? All these were reminders we were involved in a hot part of the Cold War. It's dishonest of those who report on South Africa in those years without recognizing the very real war that we were involved in. Example. If you saw the film Dirty Harry, okay, Clint Eastwood. So, if you just saw one clip of this policeman shooting a man running across the field with a wounded leg, hopping along, shoots the good leg, and then walks over and puts his leg on this man and twists it while he's screaming in agony in the middle of the field. What do you think? Police brutality. But if you understand the context, that he's kidnapped a girl who's got limited amount of air and she's dying of suffocation right now, does that maybe change one's perspective of what he's doing? Maybe it isn't police brutality. He's dealing with a brutal, sadistic murderer and he's trying to save an innocent life. Context is everything. So if you show a policeman coming with a baton and hitting somebody, police brutality. But if you show that that person was involved in Nicholas murder, mob murder of some town councillor beforehand, well, now it's a different context, isn't it? The victim can sometimes be portrayed as the villain, and the villain can sometimes be portrayed as the victim. Context. It's like when a person quotes a verse to you from the Bible and it doesn't sound right. What's the solution? Turn to the Bible, read the first few verses before it and the verses after it, and normally solves the problem. The context will normally solve the problem. History's the same. As a homeschool dad who has been homeschooling since 1991, got four children, now two grandchildren, it's dishonest of those reporting on South Africa in those years without recognizing the very real war we were involved in. This was what was happening on the roads in Southwest Africa. This is the commission in America. They had a committee of the judiciary investigate the Soviet, East German, and Cuban involvement in fomenting terrorism in South Africa. And they found out that, and they had testimony, including from Bartholomew Chlapany. Bartholomew Chlapany was a top Politburo member of the Communist Party of South Africa, who got converted, went to America, testified that the KGB of the Soviet Union totally controlled the SACP, Southern Communist Party, who totally controlled the ANC. And the ANC was, for all intents and purposes, an agent of the KGB of the Soviet Union. He testified of this in 1982, came back. He and his wife were murdered in Soweto by AK-47 wielding assassins of Mkhonto we Sizwe, and his daughter Pansy was paralyzed from neck down. 1987, I took Pansy Chlapany, pushing her wheelchair and so on, in Germany to the Kirchentag, church day in Frankfurt, a whole Lutheran World Council Churches thing, and I saw Pansy Chlapany paralyzed from neck down in a wheelchair pushing it. Lovely girl, lovely Christian girl, being threatened by communists, shaking box of matches in her face, saying, "We're going to necklace you. We're going to burn you alive." Because she's coming to testify what the communists did to her parents. I doubt that there's a school in South Africa that teaches you those sort of things. But they should, because that's part of it. We read in Romans 3, their deeds are evil deeds. Acts of violence are in their hands. Their feet rush into sin and they shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are evil thoughts, and ruin and destruction mark their ways. The way of peace they do not know. There is no justice in their path. They turn them into crooked paths. No one who walks in them will know peace. Now that was written 2,000 years ago. It's just as accurate for our dear friends in ANC today. The middle letters of cancer is ANC. And I know about cancer because my wife's been battling cancer since 2010. Cancer's horrible. A cancer cell is a cell in your body that doesn't contribute to the health of the body. It breaks down the health of the body. The ANC is a cancer. They've done nothing good for this country. They are everything that Romans 3 speaks about. They're vile, evil, corrupt. They have brought in legalized abortion, pornography, perversion. They've tried to do everything from gender confusion to turning our schools into indoctrination gulags, where they train the kids how to be whoremongering, fornicating perverts who don't even know what their gender is. That is the kind of government they are, as corrupt and vile and perverse as it comes. And I've met them, I know them, I've spoken to them, I've been in Parliament who knows how many times, submissions and so on. Even Mandela's tried to charm us and tell us what nice people are and all that. But the fact is that we've got to recognize you can't take a bunch of terrorists, communist mass murdering thugs who murdered women and children, put them into government and expect them to suddenly be reformed and become nice. They lie. They've always lied. They murder. They steal. They destroy. There's nothing else you can expect from them because they hate God. And from the very beginning, you can see it. That's why perversity flourishes in this country. And so idolizing these people and loving our chains is not the solution. The New World Order worked hard at destroying those states that were attempting to uphold Christian values. Hence the extraordinary international campaigns against Rhodesia and against South Africa in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We were Christian countries which, for all of our weaknesses and failings, were still light years better than what's replaced us. And you can see Satan's strategy. Many South Africans have recognized we do have a great calling, we do have a great responsibility, we are in the midst of a great conflict. As Vladimir Lenin said, whoever controls the tip of Africa controls the world. We want it for world communism. This is what it was like when I was in the army in 1980. All those dark areas were officially communist. We were facing a real, general, serious onslaught. And so this is why Brother Andrew said in Battle for Africa, the South African church is one of tremendous devotion to Christ. It is a spiritual muscle and financial resource to reach black Africa. I believe Satan is aware that South Africa has this potential. Consequently, works hard to isolate South Africa from the rest of the world. It has been singled out for boycott, embarrassment and criticism, particularly, I believe, because Satan wants to isolate South Africa and prevents it from fulfilling its divine commission. That was true for the 80s. Now, we've been perverted, confused, divide and conquer, or corrupt and conquer. We are being paganized as a country to destroy us as a missionary sending country. And so, to understand extraordinary campaigns to force South Africa to surrender to godless communism, we need to remember the insights of the German military strategist Clausewitz. War is an act of violence to break the enemy's will. You see, it's not the loss of men, horses and guns, but of order, courage, confidence, cohesion and plan. And it's principally the moral forces which decide here. The communists never beat us in battle. They never won a skirmish. But they won on the TV screens, they won in the classrooms, they won on the university campuses, they won through guilt manipulation, through politics of guilt and pity, through deception and through lies, and talking people to giving up. Corrupt and conquer. A nation can only be as strong as the collective moral and spiritual strength of its individual citizens. South Africans were not only under attack by communist terrorism and internal subversion, but materialism, immorality and selfishness were just as great a threat, if not a greater threat, to our strength and stability of a nation. Corrupt and conquer was plainly at work in the battle for South Africa. Unbiblical teachings, heresies, liberalism, apathy in many churches were a greater threat to our spiritual strength than all the terrorism and economic warfare. Do you know what this here is? It's the beautiful Church of Reconciliation built by the Dutch Reformed Church at Ungungungluvu, that's at Dingenstad, where Pieter Tief and his followers were all murdered. And they built this lovely church, thatched roof and so on. In 1994, the month Mandela became president, this burnt down mysteriously. They've never rebuilt it. It's still there. This is the inside of it. And this, not a word. And this is just one of many of our cultural treasures and spiritual treasures in this country, sabotaged and destroyed, undermined in one way or the other, or hijacked by the Marxists since 94. And the first battle is the battlefield of history. Karl Marx said the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. And that's why, as a homeschool father, reading different history books to my children, I got frustrated with reading lies. And my children would sometimes get surprised to see me pull out my pen and cross things out and write different dates, facts, and so on, and cross out whole sections. And my oldest daughter had no problem, you know, okay, dad knows best. My second daughter was horrified. How can a textbook be wrong? I said, well, you've got to meet some of the people who write these textbooks. I had the privilege of, at school, my first history teacher was a Member of Parliament, Mr. Rhys Davies. Mr. Rhys Davies, whose father was also a Member of Parliament, who got into trouble with Winston Churchill because he was in Britain during the Second World War, and he would oppose Churchill's draconian measures where he was putting even members of the House of Lords in prison for 6 years without trial and things like that. I mean, he's a real dictator. Hideous drunkard who did pretty abominable things. But Mr. Rhys Davies said to us, first lesson, beware the victor's version. He said, wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. Governments write textbooks. Governments lie. And he said, always ask why. Never regurgitate the back textbook. Think outside the box. Stop regurgitating textbook. And so I think it was very, very useful having a history teacher who encouraged us to think separately, differently and challenge things. Now, I did. Now, I came from Rhodesia, and I must say Rhodesia had a very good education system, especially on English and history and so on. When I came to South Africa, came to Pans High School for my matric, and I suddenly got into deep trouble with the teachers because I'd be challenging and questioning them. Just recently, we had the 40th anniversary of our matric, and got together with P. people flew from all over the world, Australia, New Zealand, wherever they're living now. And funny enough, I was the only person still living in Pinus of the whole of my matric class. And the first thing somebody said to me is, oh, you're the one who used to argue with the teacher. And well, I was taught to argue with the teacher. I mean, that's just what they expect of us in our schools in Rhodesia. That's what was expected of my parents. My parents encouraged me to argue and discuss. My dad fought all 6 years of the Second World War, and he would often say, looking at the films, it wasn't like that. And he had, you know, scorned the stupid Hollywood movies and the lies, and said, Africa Korps were honorable men. I don't believe any of these atrocity stories. They were gentlemen. This is rubbish. This is just Hollywood garbage. And so I'd learned different things. My mother was a nurse, and she'd continually tell me stories of how the doctor diagnosed it wrong and a patient almost died, but the nurse intervened at the right time. And so I wasn't brought up thinking the doctor's always right. I wasn't brought up thinking the teacher's always right, or the textbook's always right. I was brought up to question, did I get into trouble in South Africa? Wow. For example, my matric history paper, one question, 1977 history test exam, matric exam. Everything rises and falls on that. That was in the days when you got no marks throughout the year, only got your final exam. Discuss the causes and origins of the Second World War. My sort of subject, my arm was aching after the 2 hours or whatever, and Versailles Treaty and all that. I got zero. I asked for a remark and I got 98%. The teacher who marked me said, that's not what we taught you in the textbook. That's not part of the curriculum. Your answer wasn't the answer you meant to give. But the person who was higher up who did the remark said, but he quoted his facts and sources, and he obviously understood everything. And, you know, I was quoting A.J.P. Taylor and good sources like this, and I'd obviously done extra reading. And so they credited me with the marks and ended up, you know, A plus is an improvement from zero. Yeah. So, but it just shows again the mentality. Some schools teach you to think, to question. And that's education. Education is question everything. Indoctrination is telling people what to think. Education is teaching people how to think. And that's the problem. And that's where we want to really go. Well, I need to stop, but I think this great quote, we were never defeated by enemies, we were betrayed by our friends. And there's a lot on that. Now, everything I've said here in the different presentations, the different chapters and sketches from South African history, including this is a whole, we've got a whole chapter on Battle for South Africa, and I haven't even finished it, but I've made too many comments on the side. So let me stop right there, and any questions, any complaints or criticisms? Questions?
Also, just an observation. It's like, wow, were we even in those battles? I mean, it's like we were totally oblivious to the others sitting on us. I've only really become interested in history because I'm a homeschool teacher and a mommy, and I'm supposed to do research and all that. I've never really been interested in history as a child growing up, more than me. But it's like everything has just come to life, you know. Yeah, I suppose it's because we want to give the best of our knowledge, of our experiences, what we've heard, what we've seen. But when we get extra food like this, I mean, it's like, wow, it can just totally transform the way you teach, not the way you teach, but present or enrich your child life.
I'm glad to hear that, because that's certainly the intention.
I had no idea, totally clueless with regards to that Angola, Cuba, Russia thing. I was like, what? We were there?
Yeah, we certainly were, lock, stock and barrel. And tens of thousands of our men were there, actually.
Yeah. I don't know. Did apartheid have something to do with it? No. We were sort of sheltered.
No, I think it's just... I think it's typical materialistic society. They don't want to know what's going on. But bear in mind, back then, well, just for starters, the apartheid army was heavily black. I mean, like 3-2 battalion was totally integrated, made up of thousands of Portuguese-speaking ex-communist Angolan black people who'd come over there and joined our side, were fighting for us against them. We were many units, like 101 Battalion was overwhelmingly Avembos, many of them ex-SWAPO terrorists, fighting with, you might have had one South African white person amongst 20 or 30 Avembos in this unit. Bushman's Battalion, one of my friends, 3-1 Battalion. The Bushmen really fought with fury because they had been enslaved and hunted like animals for sport by the Avembos. So the Bushmen, the 3-1 Battalion, they originally were 2-1 Battalion, they were some of our best trackers, phenomenal fighters. So the South African police, Kufut, wow, most of Kufut were black soldiers, black police actually. But they were fighting like military up there. The police always regarded it as their war first and foremost because they saw terrorism as a crime, not a military threat. So the police were always there up at the border involved. And so to me, first of all, I'm told South African army is an apartheid army fighting against the blacks. But I found there were lots and lots of blacks fighting with us against the Reds. And on the other side, I found white Cubans and Russians on the other side and being strafed by Russian, East German and Cuban MiGs and Hind helicopters. So I never saw it as racial. I saw it as black and white together against Red. You know, they were the Red. We were. So we saw it as Christians. So, you know, you've got your chaplain's periods, you've got your everything. And you totally. There were times I was getting instructions from officers who are black, and there were times we were fighting and interacting at all times, and the times that we black and white together fighting against white Cubans on the other side, totally. So but why ruin a good story with the facts? So the propaganda, they try to thin it out. So for example, you take the Mandela Long Walk to Freedom film. To simplify matters, not to confuse the audience, there's no white communists in the ANC. Even at the Rivonia trial, which was mostly white communists, it's just black and Indian people who and even their defense lawyers, not white. In fact, they had white lawyers and all this. And they made it that all the police in South Africa were white. All the police at Sharpeville were white. There's no black policemen. There's no black prison guards. There's no black policemen, black soldiers. And there's no white communist ANC. So, simple. Whites are bad, blacks and others are good, and, yep, simple. But that's not the story, and that's not accurate, and that's not true. So, it's to enable them to give the story the way they would like it to have been, not the way it actually was. And they show this, and people, and, you know, inspired by true events and based on a true story. And yes, the names and the places are true. Only the facts have been changed to protect the guilty. Yeah. So yes, this is why, to me, it's so important that we know the rest of the story. Well, it was hard on quite a few levels, because in Rhodesia, first of all, we were used to wide open spaces, and I used to be able to walk outside of town and see wildebeest, zebra, giraffes, not in the game reserve, just outside the city limits of Bulawayo. I'd walk up to Kami Ruins, which is about 18 kilometers on the map. As a 12-year-old boy, I'd walk out there. My parents didn't even know where I was. You just had to be back when the sun set, you know. And to suddenly be at a place where there's so much traffic and people. And the classrooms, you know, in Rhodesia, you'd literally have shooting as part of school training on Fridays. You'd go and shoot two rifles and so on, drilling cadets. So I found Cape Town very restrictive, and the first thing that horrified me is how stinkingly liberal the white English speakers were in Highlands. I was just surrounded by liberal fools, and I came from Rhodesia, and they were all, you know, you nasty, horrible, evil, white racists from Rhodesia is oppressing black people. Where do these people come from? What are they talking about? So I was amazed at how hostile the English liberals were here. And I felt very alienated. So very, very quickly, almost all my friends were Afrikaans conservative people because I couldn't stand the English people. Even though I'm English, I just found them shockingly liberal. They were so negative. So, for example, I remember one of the first fights, and I wasn't a very aggressive boy, but first fight I got into was somebody laughing about how Rhodesia's handing over to black majority rule because Ian Smith announced one man, one vote. And I remember flattening this character. and didn't know where that came from, because I was not a fighter. I was just a quiet bookworm in the library and teacher's pet sort of thing. So, I found it very hard. Also, the biggest shock for me was coming to a co-ed school, because in Rhodesia we only had all boys and all girls schools. If there ever was a co-ed school, I don't know about it. And so suddenly I was in a school with girls, and I thought that girls were beautiful, sweet, nice creatures, and suddenly I discovered what nasty, vindictive characters they could be. I had no idea that women could be so mean. I mean, I found that they would just be tearing me apart verbally on everything. So there's nothing I could do that was right. You know, start off, you know, you're not even shaving yet, and then, you know, oh, you don't even know how to shave under your chin, and kind of clothes, oh, you've got, you know, the cheap jackets, is your family too poor that you can't? Well, just come down for the last year. Why would we buy expensive jackets when I've got only a year of schooling here? And they would just be the whole time on about everything. It was just mean, mean, mean. And I'd never interacted with any girls before in my life, so this was horrible shock. I must say that was. And, you know, when people speak about your kids are going to miss out on socialization by homeschooling, I thought, yeah, I hope so. all the socialization I had at school was bullying. I mean, in Rhodesia, I got bullied up by the boys and, you know, beaten, because I was on the wrong side there too, because in Rhodesia, the first thing was I'd come to school and they'd say, yeah, they've been hunting with their dad on the farm on the weekend or the holiday, and what have you done? I don't hunt animals. And when I realized, you don't hunt, you never hunt. Oh. Bunny hugger! They called us bunny huggers if we loved animals. And so I was a conservationist. So I would be, you know, my best friends are animals. And so just to give you an idea of how different school was in Rhodesia, we'd go to school with our pellet guns. And the teachers never mind. I mean, I'm talking about air rifle, you know, pellet guns or things. And they would come to school and they'd shoot birds during break. So I brought my air rifle to school and I said, okay, you want to shoot birds? I want to be a game ranger, so I'll shoot you if you're going to coach them. And so we ended up, break time, we'd have pitched battles. We'd be, you know, shooting one another. And I remember seeing the teacher's lounge was at a higher level, and they're standing at the big open window with their tea, watching us shoot one another in the school grounds. It never came up at a school assembly. No complaints, no discipline. And, I mean, in America, they'd close down a school and call a SWAT team. But we were half killing one another. There was brutal, brutal battles. And I remember once being behind a metal drum, metal dustbin, shooting. And I heard a bullet come through the side and rattle on the inside. And I thought, you know, what if that hits one of your eyes or something? We weren't wearing protective. I mean, we were aiming at one another's heads, and it never crossed my mind that we could be putting somebody's eye out or something. We were using these sharp point metal things and full-on battles. But, I mean, the pitched battles that we went through. To give you an idea of how it was like, because these days we've got tattletales everywhere. We could never tattletale. I mean, I don't know what would have happened if you tattletale, because I don't think anyone ever did it. Certainly, I never did. So, you know, I'd cover for my brother, no matter how brutal and bullying he was, and I'd cover for everyone at school. So I was at school, so, you know, you walk in, there's no chairs, of course, you sit on the floor. And you, when you're standing up for singing a hymn or whatever, someone from behind me with an injection, the old injections, you know, used to sterilize them, reuse them multiple times. And so this would be these big horse needle things. And this guy from behind stabbing me with this injection. And I could feel the blood trickling down my leg. But you couldn't shout or give an explanation of pain or in any way rat on someone. I mean, that's just unthinkable. Code of honor. So I'm in agony, and he's really digging. He's being sadistic. So as we file out, of course you file out line by line, so I slipped in line directly behind him. He doesn't know I'm right behind him. So as we go out, I trip him at the stairs, and he falls down the stairs, and he's got this massive glass syringe. And I went past and crushed his hand, and you heard his scream echoing throughout the courtyards when a glass from in there would have been in his hand. And I knew, like he knew, I wouldn't rat on him. He couldn't rat on me either. Didn't matter how much we hated one another. I mean, it was a code of honor. And now he's got to explain what he's doing with a whole lot of shards of glass. But that, then after that, they got me in the toilets and beat me up. And I got one of them as we were running around the football field into the thorn bushes and cactus, and then they would hit me with this, and I walk up there. This is a boys' school. This chap's head's in his desk. I lifted the lid, wham, you know, on his head. Hey, teacher, what was that? And I was, sorry, sir, I just hurt myself. And you know, somebody would stab you with their compass, you know, the needle thing, and then, you know, you'd stab them back with yours. And every single day, there would be bruises, batterings, and so on. I remember coming to a dinner table with a space helmet and a cowboy hat and a thing to cover up bruises and cuts. And because I couldn't let my parents know. You couldn't. It was unthinkable. So, I mean, that was the code of conduct you had in a boys' school. It was physical bullying, I would say, virtually every single day of the year. There was some kind of... Now, if I was to give a choice between physical bullying by boys in a boys' school or mental bullying by girls in a girls' school, in a co-ed school, I'd take the physical bullying any time, personally. I mean, I think the way the girls bully is more mean, because this business of sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never harm me, that's rubbish. Words can harm you more, much more. So, yes, I was delighted to keep my children out of that kind of socialization. My children? My oldest is married, and she's pregnant with our second child. So I've got two girls and two boys, and two girls are the oldest. My oldest, Andrea, was here earlier with her child, Jeremy.
I was joking. I was just thinking if they were sons, then you kept them away from me.
No, I wouldn't want to do that. No, I mean, I've learned since that they're nice women, but I'm just saying my first introduction was not good. No. No. So, you know, when I met these people, you know, I've met them at the 10th anniversary, the 20th anniversary. I think I missed the 30th anniversary, so I've made the 40th matric anniversary. And, I mean, they all remembered me as the animal lover, bunny hugger. Well, another thing to show you the kind of things you have at school. I had in matric, no, not matric, sorry, my first year in high school. We called Form 1. You'd call Stand 8. Grade 8. Grade 8 now, it was Standard 6. We called it Form 1. Right. So, first biology class, last biology class, we came and they had a tank of 20 little mice running around, little white mice. Teachers, today we're going to do dissection. All these sadistic rats are getting all excited. And who wants to put the gas pills in? Oh, me. Then one person gets a bright idea. Hammond, he's a bunny hugger. And so the teacher seemed to warm up this and ordered me to come front, and I wasn't interested. And they started chanting my name and insisting, and teacher insisting, yeah, Hammond, you come here and put these gas pills in. And as I walked up there, I had my first experience of seeing red. My dad would speak about seeing red. When blood comes over your eyes, you don't think straight and you just act in a rage. I walked up and I turned the whole tank on its side. Now, it's a big, like, fish tank. But what I didn't see as I turned it on its side was there's a glass lid on the top. And it, like, a few hundred pieces. And the mice were running off and all over the place. And the teacher's running to get, and then I tried to stop the teacher from catching the mice, and I kicked him in the shins by accident. He fell amongst the glass, cutting himself, and people are screaming. So this was disaster. They had a rule that if you had to get caned, you'd be sent to the vice principal, and he could do it with a real bamboo cane. 6 cuts. And I must have got 18 or more that day, because they were all, you know, you can imagine kicking a teacher. So, not that I meant to, but I was banned from biology forever, which I thought, great, I mean, I don't want to cut up. I mean, I'm not into that sort of thing at all. So, a few years ago, obviously I've infected my children with this animal activism. So we got our different things coming in, Bob Jones University. So there's, I get all kinds of homeschooling packages. So brought this one home and I heard my daughter open, pack it in the kitchen and go, ugh. And then my other daughter, Danielle, goes, what? And Andrea's saying, you don't want to look, Danielle, don't look. And then next thing, blood curdling screams, screaming and screaming. I came running down the hallway with gun in hand thinking someone's being attacked. It turned out it was a dissection kit. They had in Ziploc bags dead frogs and things like this and mice or whatever. And, I mean, somebody in America sort of gonking these guys and Ziploc-ing them. So it was your dissection project. We packed this up, cancelled biology, handed it to another family, and my daughter was saying, you know, it's like a Jeffrey Dahmer do-it-yourself kit. I had to learn to be some kind of sadistic cannibal or something. So my family's not into the biology side. I'd rather shoot poachers, you know. But, wow. Really, you can imagine how well I fit in Rhodesia. I mean, everybody seemed to be a hunter, and here's this guy rooting for the animals. So, yes, I don't think I did very well at school. I did well academically, but socially. My children were asking about my friends when I was at school, and I said, Vivian the lioness, Malcolm the leopard, Tim my cat, Tiger my cat. They said, but were there any people? No people. I can honestly say I went through all my time school, Rhodesia and South Africa, without one single human friend. And wasn't a sociable person. But my cats loved me. This picture's interesting because it's South African troops, Springbok Legion, liberating Addis Ababa from the Italians. The history books will tell you the British liberated Addis Ababa. Actually, it was the South Africans. But that's a bit embarrassing. Because Ethiopia is the head of the Organization of African Unity. You can't say the South Africans liberated you from colonialism. So let's say the British did it. It doesn't have to be true, but history is rewritten in order to accommodate the present, whatever the present narrative is. So you can switch it off if you want. Any other questions, comments, complaints? Yeah, we just do it twice then. Questions, comments? For Kuan or I, any questions?
Well, I was going to ask if you had any questions, but you covered them. But I think it would be fair to say never let your schooling get in the way of your education.
That is a fact.
Awesome. Yeah.
This is why we would rather speak about home education than home schooling. Because if you think about it, schooling is what we're actually trying to get away from.
Yeah. Yeah.
This regimented, sit in these chairs, you know, say this, stand up, do that. That's not education.
Yeah.
What we're after is not so much trying to replicate at home what they're doing in the schools. We're trying to do something completely different. We're trying to educate our children to think critically for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so my children often argue with me, which is what I want. I want them to think about it. I want them to question it. Now, we've done government schools, we've done Christian schools, we've done homeschooling, and we've done a lot of homeschooling. And as a result, we've got a pretty good spread, because about 8 years between my oldest and youngest, and the experiences that they had, it depends on, you can sometimes have a good experience in some government schools, the early ones, if you've got the right school governing body and a brave principal and courageous teachers, but gee, they're working against the and they're fighting a tidal wave of pressure in the textbooks. The problem I've got with a lot of Christian schools today, because we've just sent, after my wife had cancer, we had quite a lot of medical problems, kidney failure with my son and so on, transplants. My wife gave the kidney and then she got cancer 6 months later. So in all that debacle of that year, we put our two boys back into a school, an independent Christian school. And we quickly discovered independent Christian schools are not that independent and they're not that Christian.
Yep.
At least not this one wasn't.
Absolutely.
The same Mandela mania, right, tributes to Nelson Mandela, saying happy birthday, all this, and think, what's this got to do with education? This is politics.
Mm-hmm.
And my son spent his time arguing with the teachers and, you know, they say things, well, how do you know? So, well, he's been there. And actually, my son had. And he had so many Zulu friends and so many friends up in Zambia, and he'd been all over these places. And he knew Ulundi and the Battle of Rooksdrift and Isiwanda, like he'd been there. He had been there, actually. And, you know, we'd walked our way through, we discussed it so much. And so getting this rubbish from these indoctrination gulag commissars in the local school. Of course he would, and after a while he'd come back and he'd say, you know, it's so hard for me to respect these teachers. I can understand. I mean, it is hard to respect them. They're mouthpieces for lies and propaganda. Yeah. And there's some, many of them are well-meaning, but many of them just don't know. They regurgitate the stuff because that's what they were taught.
They must get through.
Yeah. So we don't want to be obnoxious, but we do want to be principled. And that's why it's good to read from all sides. And always realize there's always another side to every single story. There's never just one side. And so I like that Bayakuan tries to give the different sides and perspective and how do the others see it, and not just to look at it from our perspective. And as a missionary, that's what we've got to do. I mean, I've been 36 years a missionary going into all kinds of countries. I debate Muslims. And so I've come to understand Islam from such a point that I think I could explain Islam's perspective on something, even as I could dismantle it because I oppose it. I've got a lot of communist books, if you've been paying attention, and a lot of Muslim books. It's not that we believe it, but we want to know what our enemies say and think, because we want to win them for Christ. So I've got no problem going into communist meetings. I've been in communist meetings. I've been in communist bases. I've sat in the mosques. I've learned from these people. I've debated these people. And I'm confident with, I can go to the evolutionists, the abortionists, whatever. I don't fear their opinions. Truth doesn't fear investigation. And so I'm not bothered if somebody teaches a whole lot of things that I don't believe or that my son doesn't believe, because if we investigate and look at some different sides, we'll get to the truth. And if they're right and we're wrong, well, then we need to recognize that too. And I could give you a long catalogue of where I've been wrong. I was an agnostic, I was an atheist. I've gone through so many things and been convinced that I was wrong. There was a time that I was arguing and debating in school for abortion, for euthanasia. Obviously, I don't know. We changed our views. And there were times that I believed very different things to what I believe now, including times when I was anti-Calvinist and speaking out against the Reformed faith.
Sure.
And I've got a son called Calvin now. So obviously we changed our points on that one. Right, any other questions? For me, Kieran, any of us?
Have you been officially excommunicated from the Catholic Church yet, Peter?
I never was a Catholic.
No, I mean, they told you you can't join.
Well, I went to a Catholic school for a while, and even took confession and mass and all that nonsense. But I never was a Catholic. My parents were secular, but they sent me to Catholic school because it was good academically. But I've had some American churches tell me they've excommunicated me. Well, I'm not an American. I've never belonged to your church. So, sorry, you can't actually excommunicate me. It's none of your business. And every reformer got excommunicated a few times. I think Huss got excommunicated 5 times. Apparently once wasn't enough. Yes, it can be a badge of honor.